when the nurse was absent, showing the intruder to be well acquainted with the ways of the house, my suspicion turned to certainty.
How blind I've been.
Now, the facts of the case, as far as I can work them out, are these. Joseph entered the office from the Charles Street door and walked straight to your room, moments after you'd left. Finding no one, he promptly rang the bell, but as he did so, his eye fell upon the treaty. He recognized it as a state document of immense value, and in an instant thrust it into his pocket and was gone. He hadn't just enough time to make his escape.
Yes, of course. Well, it took a few moments for poor Tangy to tell me the bell was from my room.
Indeed. And I may ask you to use your influence on his behalf sometime later, but let us continue. Joseph returned at once to Woking, and in the secrecy of his room examined his prize. He could see at once there was a long price to be had from it, so he concealed it with the intention of selling it to the highest bidder a few days later. Then your sudden return, he's bundled out of the room, and from then on there were always at least two people between him and the treaty.
That must have maddened him.
Then he thought he saw his chance.
Yes, but the night he broke in, I'd not taken my usual sleeping car.
Otherwise, he might have succeeded. So, knowing he would repeat the attempt whenever he deemed it safe, I arranged for you to leave, Miss Harrison to stay there all day to forestall him, then retire, leaving the room empty, except for the odd nocturnal visitor.
The shame all this will bring on Annie and her family.
Oh, perhaps not. All I was after was the treaty, and having got it, I let my man go.
But why, in heaven's name?
Well, it saves embarrassment all round for the government, Lord Holdhurst, and perhaps even Mr. Percy Phelps here.
Thank you, Holmes. And for Annie as well.
But it does seem as if Harrison got off rather lightly.
Oh, not lightly, Watson.
Now listen to me, you wretched, squirming creature.
The affairs of state dictate that your prosecution would cause more trouble and vexation than it's worth. But at any time in the future, all the details can be handed over to Forbes of Scotland Yard, and then you'd find yourself in prison for a considerable amount of time. Do you understand me?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
Don't you thank me, Harrison. Rather than look in my eyes. Believe what I say. One error, one slight little straying from the path, and I shall crush you underfoot as I would a slug on a damp autumn day. I have put my mark on you, Master Joseph, and you will carry it till the day you die.
No, I wouldn't say lightly. Well then, Mr. Phelps, now there can be no obstacle between you and the forthright Miss Harrison.
I don't really know how to thank you, Holmes. Perhaps you'd like to come to the wedding. Annie and I would be so pleased.
No. Thank you, no. Both weddings and funerals I avoid whenever possible.
Oh, come now, Holmes.
No, but Watson here will attend, I'm sure. In fact, he's the very man to give you any advice you may require on the matter, because he's made such a grand success of his own matrimonial dealings.
Well, it makes a nice change from dealing with you for all these years.
And do you have any advice for me, Watson?
Well, marriage is not unlike a treaty between two countries, one foreign to the other. You agree on the details, get it drawn up in a language you both understand, then sign the thing. But for goodness sake, folks, don't lose it this time. Now, let's have that breakfast.
In The Naval Treaty, Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Medicine and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams, with Patrick Malahide as Percy Phelps. Annie Harrison was played by Joanna Myers, Joseph Harrison by Stephen Tompkinson, Inspector Forbes by David Bannerman, Lord Holdhurst by Brett Usher, Mr. Tangy by Norman Jones, and Miss Tangy by Petra Markham. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Naval Treaty was dramatized for radio by David Ashton and directed by Patrick Raynor.